Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that we got going on over there. And while you're over there, check out the events page because we've got an event coming up in Northwest Arkansas. That's in Bentonville, April 16th and 17th. Chad will be there. I'll be there. A whole bunch of other people will be there. Andy Gullihorn will be doing a whole concert. It's filling up, Chad. We have a limited amount of tickets because it's not a huge venue that we're going to be in. So looks like that is going to sell out. So if you want to go to that, you better get in there and grab one of those tickets. You can find all the information over at the website. We sort of left Saul in an interesting spot. We left David in an interesting spot as well. Both of them. We had this weird thing where we had a break in the action. So David has been out raiding villages and claiming that he was raiding villages in Israel. The king has decided it's time to go to war with Israel again and has informed David that he is expected to be there. In fact, you're going to be my bodyguard. Meanwhile, Saul is freaked out and has contacted a medium, raised Samuel's spirit or himself, something from the dead, something has gone on. And Samuel has told Saul, yeah, I haven't got any war advice for you, but by the end of tomorrow, you and your sons will be with me. And that's how we left it.
Yeah, on that high and positive note.
Yeah.
Last time.
Yeah. And we discussed, maybe kind of positive. There's a positive way to look at it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's a whole lot. I would, if Samuel were to appear to me and say, hey, Chad, tomorrow you're going to be with me, I'd a whole lot rather him say that than say, hey, Chad, tomorrow you're going to be not with me, but in another bad in a bad place. So,
yeah, I mean,
relatively speaking, it's pretty good news.
Yeah, you could say tomorrow you will die and you will never see me again. That would be bad. That would be bad. That would make me freaked out for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, it's some good news. We're going to wrap up that chapter. We only have a few verses left. We're at 1 Samuel chapter 28, verse 20, and there's 25 verses, so we'll wrap up those five verses. And then we've got a short chapter coming up, but an interesting chapter in a number of ways where David does at least head toward the battle on the Philistine side. And the Philistines are getting ready for this major offensive against the Israelites. So we'll find out what happens to David. But let's wrap up the story of Saul first. So Samuel has just disappeared. He's given his proclamation of not only Saul's impending death, but also Saul's sons' impending deaths, as well as the defeat of Israel. So that is the final prophecy that Samuel utters. I can't say on this side of the grave, on the other side of the grave. Anyway, it's his final prophecy, period. Saul reacts to this, as you might expect, with shock and dismay. He falls down on the ground, says he's very afraid because of the words of Samuel. There's no strength in him because he had not eaten all day and all night. So either he's not eating because his stomach is so upset with worry that he can't eat, or he's fasting. You may remember from an earlier episode, we talked about how Saul has this had this strange idea that soldiers should fast before this battle, which, as we talked about then, was sheer lunacy because you want people to be optimally physically prepared for combat, not walking around with an empty stomach. But perhaps that's kind of a thing with Saul. He likes to fast, and maybe he's been fasting in preparation for this encounter with Samuel. But whatever it is, he's not only weakened physically by that, but he's weakened, we might say, emotionally or spiritually or just holistically by everything that he's just experienced during this, I don't know what you want to call it, seance or something like that. Anyway, the woman comes to Samuel, I mean to Saul, and Saul, he was terrified, and she says, look, I've done what you told me to do. I've taken my life in your hand. And I've listened to the words which you spoke to me. In other words, I did what you said. Now, verse 22, she says, now, why don't you do what I say? So I listened to you. Now you listen to me. I'm going to put some bread in front of you. so that you can eat it and get some strength and be on your way. I'm thinking she probably is ready to get rid of this guy.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if this is like just a move of compassion, like, oh, you seem really freaked out and really anxious. You probably need to eat something here. Like, you know, like her motherly genes kicked in or something. I don't think it's that. I think it's like, all right, I'm going to need you to eat that and get the heck out of here.
Yeah, yeah. Here's a Cliff Bar for the road.
Yeah.
Chew that while you're heading back to your camp. But it doesn't work out that way for whatever reason. So he first of all refuses. He says, nope, I'm not going to eat. But together with the woman, the servants of Saul basically just kind of strong arm him, push him into finally eating. And so he does listen to them. He gets off the ground. He'd just been evidently lying there this whole time. And he sat on her bed. And the woman, well, she ends up giving him a lot more than a piece of bread. She had a fattened calf in the house. You may remember, well, I don't know if we've talked about this or not, but you may know that it was not unusual back in this particular culture to have animals in the house with you. I'm not talking about dogs and cats. I'm talking about sheep and goats and cattle. A lot of homes were set up where there was an area downstairs where at least during the night when they needed to be protected from whatever might get them from predators, they would be kept inside. Or maybe, you know, on days like, well, half the country is experiencing right now where it's like,
yeah.
I'm here in South Texas and I woke up to 10 degrees and I think it was like zero in Arkansas this morning.
Yeah. No degrees.
So if my wife and I had like a fattened calf that we usually kept in the backyard, well, that fat calf, I guess, would have been coming in the house with us because he wouldn't have made it through the night.
Oh, right. Right before we got on here, I was forcing the dog as I was going to be doing this. I'm like, yeah, you got to go do your business. And she was not about it. I mean, like, I opened that door and I had to get behind her and push her out the door.
yesterday, and I know this is an aside, but it's funny. So yesterday I had to get my snow shovel out. And since I used to live where we actually get snow, I actually own a snow shovel. And I had to snow the back porch and a portion of the grass so our little dachshund would actually be able to go outside. He was he was like your dog. He was not loving this weather. He hates it. So, but he was forced to go outside and use the spot I cleared for him.
He wasn't like interested in running around in it. It was just do it and then right back to the door, right?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. With a scowl of hatred on his face the whole time. Yeah, we forced him to do this.
It's wild that we had a snow. This is a big aside, but well, you know, whatever. We had a snow earlier this year. It was one of those snows, though, that where it's like 27 degrees. It snows a whole bunch. My dog loved it. Like, she wanted to be outside, and she wanted to run around in it. The difference between, like, 27 and zero is substantial.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so it was not very pleasant out there. Still is not. In fact, as we're recording, we're hoping and praying that my electricity will stay on long enough for us to finish 40 minutes because we've been having rolling blackouts for the last 2 days. So we shall see what happens.
I will say this about the text. It does seem that as Saul's offered this food and then he refuses, this sort of does make you believe that he is sort of in some kind of like wartime fast or something, you know, where people are like, hey man, you really need to eat. And he's like, look, I'm not doing that. And has to be convinced, not just by her, but by the people with him. Like, you're not going to be any good in a battle, dude. Like, you have to eat. And it is interesting that, you know, she was like, here, I'm going to give you some bread, but then turns around and says, actually, I'll go further than that. Like, we'll get you fed so you can get out of here.
Yeah. Yeah. She's got this fattened calf in the house. So she slaughters it. And she makes some flour, kneads it, bakes some unleavened bread. I mean, this could take a while. It wasn't like she whipped this up and 30 minutes later she had some veal and a loaf of unleavened bread in front of Saul. This would have taken some time, so they were probably there for several hours. But anyway, she makes it, brings it to Saul, and they ate, and they arose and went away that night. It's a weird situation. I mean, the whole thing, this whole chapter is, of course, extremely strange. You got the king of Israel, who supposedly has driven out all these mediums and necromancers, and then he has to find one, and he does find one, and goes to her. So this witch, or whatever you want to call her. I mean, and then not only does he consult her, but now he's having a meal.
You know, yeah,
he's going to have this nice feast in the home of a necromancer. I mean, it's just, this whole thing is kind of surreal. It's got so many different strange dimensions to it, but that's the way it wraps up with this meal inside the home of the necromancer, and then they leave. Okay, so as you mentioned at the beginning, Dan, this is this whole beginning at chapter 28, the beginning of that, where you have the forces of the Philistines getting together from 28 through 29, and then a little bit into 30 as well. You've got several things that are not sequential. So basically, this is what happens. So you've got the Philistines that are gathering their forces at a place known as Aphek. So they're gathering their forces there, and then they're gonna move them to a place that is known as Shunem. All right. So first of all, they're gonna kind of mass together in Aphek, which is on the northern side of the Philistine territory, and they're gonna move from there to a place that's known as Shunem. And we hear about that back in chapter 28. All right, so that's going on. And that is when Saul really gets nervous. He sees all these forces. They've gathered at Aphek, and then they moved up to Shunem. Saul sees them all gathered together, so he goes to see this witch. And in the next morning is when we're going to have the major battle. All right, so while all that is going on, to go back to David now, We're gonna catch up with David at the beginning of chapter 29, when he is with his king, this Philistine king Achish, and they're gathering together at Aphek. All right, so we're kind of going back in time. So Saul is right now on the morning in which he's going to go out and fight against the Philistines, and David, we're kind of back in time where the Philistines are just beginning to gather their forces. Okay, so chapter 29, as I mentioned, it's short, 11 verses, and this is where we find out if David is going to have to go against his brothers, the Israelites, or not. So the Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek, while the Israelites were camped by the spring, which is in Jezreel. And the lords of the Philistines were proceeding on by hundreds and by thousands, and David and his men were proceeding on in the rear with Achish. So you remember that Achish had said to David, "You're going with me. I know you've been living for, you know, 16 months, whatever it was. Yeah, 16 months. I know you've been living for 16 months in Ziklag, and I know that you've been doing these raids against Judah," or at least he thought David was. "Well, now we're going to go in this major offensive against the Israelites, and I want you to be with me." And David somewhat coyly said, "Oh, I'll show you what I can do. Yeah, yeah, definitely show you what I can do." Which Achish is naively believes that David is saying, "I'll show you what I can do against the Israelites." David is really just kind of leaving this wide open.
He's just saying, he's saying, "I'll show you what kind of guy I am."
Yeah, nothing more, right? You'll find out. Just hide and watch.
And by the way, this is shaping up not to be like just kind of some like skirmish or something. I mean, there's a lot of guys here. So I mean, when it says that, you know, they're sort of gathering together for this major offensive, like this is going to be a big battle. This isn't the Philistines were doing something over here, and you know, David or Saul got some guys together and they went and drove them out or anything like that. This is line up your guys and let's do this kind of battle.
And we're never told why they did this, but I wonder, you can just kind of following this story, if the Philistines have not realized that Saul is extremely weak. He doesn't have the support of his followers anymore. David is no longer in the picture. And so maybe they're thinking to themselves, "You know what? This is our chance. Let's get everybody together, and this will be our opportunity to finally take out the Israelites once and for all." So we're, like I said, we're not told, but at least I wonder if that maybe was the reason for this major offensive at this time. But whatever it was, David is with his Philistine benefactor, I guess we'd call him, Achish. And Achish has said to David, you're going to be my, literally my head guard, my bodyguard. You're going to take care of me. So that's, of course, why David is sticking pretty close to Achish. Now, they come up there. So we don't know exactly how the Philistines realized these weren't like fellow Philistines. Maybe it's by the way they dressed or something else. But the commanders of the Philistines are like, this is verse 3. What are these Hebrews doing here? This by the way, happens to be the way that a lot of non-Israelites address or refer to Israelites. They call them Hebrews. So maybe it actually might even be kind of a pejorative term. Like, you know, what are these guys? What are these Hebrews doing here? It might not have been just a kind of a neutral term, but instead a negative term in the mouths of the Philistines. And you can understand, you're like, what the heck are you doing? Why are you bringing Hebrews to battle? Because you do realize we're just about to go against the Hebrews.
Yeah.
This makes no sense. Now, you got to love Achish. And it didn't hit me until this morning when I was looking over this. But I think one of the reasons that David, of all the places, of all the Philistine places he could have gone, that he went to the city of Achish, I think the reason he did this is because he realized that Achish wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed, that he was possibly the most gullible, easily duped of the Philistine leaders. Because listen to the way that Achish explains who this is and, you know, why he brought him. This is the way he starts out. He says to the commanders of the Philistines, well, isn't this David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel, who's been with me these many days, or rather these years, and I have found no fault in him from the day that he deserted to me to this day. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm about to make my case for why these Hebrews are with me, the last thing that I want to do is begin by introducing this guy as David, quote, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel.
Yeah, no.
Doesn't seem smart to me.
No. It's almost like the Philistine commanders are like, what's with all these Hebrews? And he says, no, these aren't just any Hebrews. These, yeah. This is David. Don't you understand? You know David. He killed a bunch of us. Right. I don't know how this is helpful.
I don't know how this is helpful either. No, he didn't even, you're right. It's not like they looked over there and they're like, isn't that David?
No.
They're like, no, they just know it's a bunch of Hebrews. All he had to say would have been like, oh yeah, well, don't worry about it. These guys are mercenaries. They've been working for me for a while. No big deal. But no, he's got to not only identify David, but he's got to define him as the servant of Saul, the king of Israel. You know, the guy that we're going to do battle against. Yeah,
it's David, renowned Philistine slayer.
Yeah. That, of course, is why we have him here. So he claims, you know, that, of course, David has deserted to him, and he's been with him days and years, and, well, a little bit of exaggeration there on the years part. He's been with him for, not even with him. He's been in his territory for 16 months. Anyway, the commanders of the Philistines are having nothing to do with this. They're mad. They're angry. And they say to Achish, make the man go back, that he may return to his place where you have assigned him, and do not let him go down to battle with us, lest in the battle he become an adversary to us. For with what could this man make himself acceptable to his Lord? Would it not be with the heads of these men? And then once more, we've heard this multiple times in David's story, but once more we hear the two-line song that the girls made up years ago about David. Isn't this not David, of whom they sing in the dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands. That song just comes back to haunt David over and over.
Yeah, this is a pretty good argument by the commanders here. They're like, oh yeah, listen, let me explain to you how this could work. say there's a guy and he is on the outs with his lord, with the king. Now, there's one way you could get in the good on the good side of the king, and that would be if you went down to battle with us and all of a sudden turned on us and brought a bunch of our heads to the king. This would be a good way to do that. I don't know if you've thought this through or not, but if you're on the outs, that's a way to get in the ends.
Yeah, Akisha's not been thinking clearly, but obviously his fellow commanders are thinking very clearly. I mean, yeah, it's and you know, in their defense, not that they need defending, but in their defense, I think that's exactly what David was planning on doing. The thing is, we're never told exactly what David's plan was.
Yeah, we weren't told what his plan, but there we have no reason to think he was going to actually fight against Israel.
It would have been immoral, of course. He's going against his fellow Israelites, but it also would have been just on the political side, political suicide.
Yeah.
I mean, he knows he's supposed to be king. He probably knows that it's getting closer, getting pretty close, in fact. So to think that he could go against his fellow Israelites with the Philistines and then later assume the throne of Israel and be supported by his fellow Israelites, nah. Ain't happening.
I mean, you are talking about a guy who would not kill Saul.
Yes, right, right.
I don't think he's probably going to go out and kill, you know, hundreds and hundreds of Israelites. I don't think he's going to do that.
No, we don't know if David ever wanted to be in this situation, but now that he has found himself in this situation, then he's thinking three steps ahead of everybody else, as he almost always does. So he had his plan, and the Philistines, at least the Philistines besides Achish, they had this figured out themselves. So Achish turns to David and he says to him something very odd. I had not noticed this until was reviewing this text this morning. He swears by the name of Yahweh, which is just an odd thing for a Philistine to do. He says, as the Lord lives, as Yahweh lives, you have been upright and you're going out and you're coming in with me in the army are pleasing in my sight. For I have not found evil in you from the day of your coming to me to this day. Nevertheless, you are not pleasing in the sight of the Lord's, so go back, go in peace, so that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines. So I don't know quite what to make of this. Is Achish sort of trying to work both sides of the theological fence here? Is he worshiping the God of the Philistines as well as Yahweh now? Or is he just kind of bending over backwards to try and make up with David and using the name of David's God in this oath to him? We can't tell, but it is very strange to hear from the lips of a Philistine, as Yahweh lives. Yeah. Not something that we would have expected.
Yeah, I think David has successfully manipulated his way into the heart of the king here, and the you know, you could tell that the king is kind of proud that David's his guy now, and that's clouding his judgment, obviously. And so it seems that what he's doing is kind of saying like, hey, we're still good, man. Like everything's fine. I have no reason not to trust you. Like the other people, though, they don't know you the way I do, you know. So they're a little skeptical. So You just go back. I'll be home for dinner, you know, that kind of thing. But this king has like a bro crush on David, and he really likes the idea that David is someone that he now considers like part of his little, you know, his little squad.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Given all of that, you really have to listen to David's words and be impressed with his theatrical ability. I mean, David is, he's an actor. He's shown this multiple times. So he pretends as if he is just very deeply offended by what has just happened. So verse 8, David says to Achish, but what have I done? And what have you found in your servant from this day when I came before you to this day, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord, the king? All right, once more, we have ambiguity. So earlier, Akish had said, hey, you're going to battle with me. And David's like, oh, yeah, I'll show you what I can do. You just watch. I'll show you. And now he says, well, first of all, you know, of course, he pretends to be offended. Well, what have I done? You know, why can't I go out? Because I wanted to go out and fight against, quote, the enemies of my lord, the king. Well, see, here's the deal. Multiple times in this narrative, David has used those exact words, except the referent of my lord, the king, was Saul.
Yeah.
So Achish is going to hear this as if David, of course, is talking to him, as if Achish is David's lord and king. But from the lips of David, you know exactly what he's talking about. Hey, I was ready, willing to go out and fight against the enemies of my lord, the king.
Yeah, I mean, go read the book of Psalms. I mean, the David is, after all, a poet, a man with a vocabulary. He does have a way with words. You ever heard, you know, the Psalm 23? You ever recited that thing? It's kind of beautiful. Yeah, David wrote that. And this is the sort of stuff that David can do. He's quick with the tongue. And it takes a certain amount of hubris to have been raiding villages of Philistines and killing everyone in those villages for like a year. And then saying to the king, what do you mean? What have I done? I mean, this is crazy amounts of confidence. Have I done anything to make you not trust me? Yeah, dude. I mean, you've been doing stuff the entire time you've been here that if you got found out, you'd be getting blasted. But no, he's got to keep this act going and act as though, I guess I won't go if that's what my lord the king doesn't want. But this hurts me.
Yeah, this hurts me deeply. I mean, I could not wait to go out and fight.
And if you didn't think that this king has a bro crush on David before, you just wait till you hear his next words.
Yeah, so he's now, at this point, he's defended David to his fellow commanders, and he's defended David to David, saying, yeah, man, I know you're innocent. Well, now he's going to up his game even more. So after David is protesting and saying, what have I done? Then Achish says to him, this is verse 9, I know that you are as blameless in my sight, are you ready for this, as an angel of God.
Yeah, this is crazy.
Over the top. I know that you, I mean, I've never said this to a person in my life. Nor will I ever say this to a person in my life. And this is from a Philistine. David, I know that you are as blameless in my eyes as an angel of God. Wow. Nevertheless, he says, the commanders of the Philistines, hey, they say, you got to go. Man, you shall not go to battle with us.
It's not me. It's them.
It's not me. It's them. Listen, if I had my way, you'd be by my side. We'd be killing Israelites from dawn to dusk. And I know that because of your angelic innocence, that I can trust you implicitly. But hey, it's, you know, it's not me, it's not you, it's them. So you got to go home. Now, interestingly, as far as I know, and I'm pretty sure this is the case, as far as I know, no one else in the entire Bible, no other regular person, I should say, in the entire Bible is called or compared to an angel of God besides David. And it doesn't just happen here. It happens on two other occasions as well. We're going to get to those. One is in 2 Samuel 14, and then one is in 2 Samuel 19. So three different people on three different occasions compare David or David's integrity or David's innocence to an angelic kind of status, which is interesting. My mind, of course, goes in multiple directions here. On the one hand, it's just kind of silly from the mouth of Achish. Yeah, I mean, come on. Nobody's that innocent. But then when you look at these other two occurrences, it's like, now what is it about David makes people want to compare him to an angel of God? Possibly if we wanted to look at this in the big perspective, we could say, well, you know, after all, the son of David is the Malach Yahweh. He is the messenger of the Lord, or the quote unquote angel of God. And And here we have David compared similarly. I would have nothing against that. I don't know if we can fully make that exegetical argument, but it certainly is intriguing to me anyway. I'll leave it at that. But the only person in the Bible who's compared to this angel of God is David, and it happens three times, and it just so happens that the son of David is also the not compared to, but called the messenger of God.
It seems to me that this might just be a, I don't know, I don't think there's probably anyone in the Bible that is able to sort of bend the affections of people and gain the applause of people the way that David is. It seems like it might just be a way of people saying, you're different.
Yeah.
And David is just excels at this sort of thing. I mean, he's got people, he's got girls doing dances and singing songs in the streets that the Philistines know.
Yeah.
It's how widespread this stuff is. I mean,
they didn't like hear this on the radio. They weren't like tuned in to the Israelite radio station and picked up these girls singing this. I mean, for a song to make its way from one culture to another, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about a guy that almost everybody loves, with the exception of a key figure, Saul, who hates him because that everybody loves him. I mean, I don't think it's something that is only natural for David. I mean, David he's just so likable and stuff. That might be part of it. But David also knows how to work this whole thing. He knows how to draw people to himself. That's what he's done here. I mean, with David, who is you know, got away with words. He's a poet, and he rattles off some stuff. This king just tries to join in the flowery language with him, and is like, "You're as blameless as an angel." I mean, you're getting ready for a battle, dude. Like, who talks like this?
Yeah, curse verses to angels, swears by the name of his God.
Yeah.
Defends him against his fellow Philistines.
Yeah, this guy's got it bad for David, man. It's kind of sad.
It is. I will say this, and I think I maybe mentioned this an episode or two ago, but throughout our time in 1 Samuel, well, ever since David was introduced, my overall view of him has slightly altered. I mean, of course, we all know about David, you know, we've all read his stories and whatnot, but spending this much time with him and diving this deep into his stories and kind of his personality and his psychology and all that kind of stuff. It's impossible for me not to like him, but at the same time, I'm also like pulling back a little bit, just because anybody who's this slick and this just amazing when it comes to convincing people of whatever he wants to convince them of is slightly dangerous, or maybe greatly dangerous. I'll say that I think I have a much more well-rounded opinion of him now. Is he still like a hero type figure? Well, of course, yeah. I mean, it's impossible for him not to be. But there's also this kind of flip side of him that makes me a little nervous.
Yeah, well, David's the kind of guy that you look at, and I think you see this because of just certain aspects of his life, but David's the sort of guy that it's a very good thing that he was a man after God's own heart, that God has said this of him.
That's a good way to put it.
Because if he were not, a man with his particular skill set is incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, yeah. Just imagine if the Philistines had a David.
Right.
You know, what he would have been able to do. Yeah.
And he's always been like this, by the way, too. I mean, I think people are like, oh, he was the runt out and tending the sheep and stuff like that. David was actually different than Saul, who Saul sort of actually had this sort of, I don't know if it was a piousness, but there was a sort of simpleness about Saul, a sort of naiveness about him. I mean, David from the jump is like, I'll kill anybody. I'll kill a bear, I'll kill a lion, I'll kill a giant, I don't care.
Yeah.
David has never been this guy that, I mean, I don't think David's knees have ever knocked.
Yeah, I don't think they ever have. Or remember, I mean, when we're first really introduced to him, besides his coronation or his secret anointing, I mean, he doesn't just go out onto the battlefield and kill Goliath. No, he takes advantage of the opportunity to deliver this rather long and eloquent speech. And it's a great speech, especially for a teenager. He's clear, he's forthright, he's eloquent, and he's highly theological already at that point. And of course, his speaking ability, his rhetorical ability, just continues to sharpen over time. And of course, we see this in the case of his ability to pull the wool over Achish's eyes, so that he thinks David is of angelic innocence, more or less.
Yeah, David's got all the speech going on. He's most of the time his speech is the opposite of like the other famous type of speech, which is like the Spartan speech of one-liners, famous stuff like when you roll in and say, "Hey, drop all your weapons and we can be at peace," and you say, "Come and take them." This is David is normally the opposite of that. He's more flowery and like gives longer speeches, but every once in a while, like we have seen David, when he'll say something like, you will see what I can do. That's a little Spartan-esque. So he can do both.
Yeah, he can go both routes. Yeah, so and we're near the end of this chapter of chapter 29. And speaking of which, I mean we are not far. I don't know if people realize this, but we are not far from the end of the end of 1 Samuel.
Yeah.
We got chapter 30 and we got chapter 31. So we are coming close to a major division in the life of David. One thing I wanted to put out here, just to kind of pull this whole chapter together, is I was doing some looking this morning about the parallels that are suggestive between what happens here between Achish and David, and then what happens later on with Pontius Pilate and Jesus. I mean, it's nothing that I'd want to push too far and be like, yeah, this is definitive, but it is. I do find it intriguing. You got in both cases, you've got of course David, and then you have the Messiah, you have the son of David, and you have two rulers, two leaders. You've got, and they're both non-Israelite. You've got Achish, who is a Philistine king. You got Pilate, who is a Roman ruler of sorts, a political appointee who's in charge of this particular area of the Roman Empire. And the major parallel between these two is that in both cases, there is a threefold defense of the innocence of the one who was accused. So three different times, Achish defends the innocence of David. And then on three different occasions, for certainly in the Gospel of Luke, Pilate defends the innocence of Jesus. He says, basically, look, I've examined him. I find no guilt in this man. And he repeats this on three different occasions. And in both cases, you kind of have this ironic background here, because they're both more or less accused of being seditious, you know, causing some either causing or at least potentially causing some breakup in the kingdom. And in both cases, the charges are both untrue as well as true, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I mean, sure, it what Jesus was doing and what David was doing was going to undermine the kingdom. There's no doubt about it, because they were about another kingdom, about God's kingdom. Though they were innocent, of course, Jesus in a way different than David, still, there was a certain truth to the charge, even though the charge itself was not worthy, of course, of what happened to our Lord. But anyway, it's a kind of a fascinating parallel here, and some commentators have actually suggested that the way that the whole scene with Pilate is structured was built off this predecessor in 1 Samuel 29. So anyway, just an interesting way to kind of wrap up that chapter. Possible foreshadowing here, what's going to happen later on. So we'll find out in chapter 30 what happens next, and it's quite a surprise. While David and his men are on their way, presumably to fight, find out they're not going to fight. Well, it turns out when they go back home the next morning, they go home to a surprise, not the good kind of surprise either. While they were away, some of the enemy, the Amalekites, you'll recognize those names, they decided to take advantage of this situation where there were no fighting men left behind to defend Ziklag, to make a raid. And so we're going to have a pretty tense scene when David and his men arrive back in Ziklag, and we'll see what happens from there.
Sounds good. Yeah, we will tackle David's journey back to his sort of home, his temporary home, next week. I'll see you then, Chad.
All right. See you then.